Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Podcast. Social distance, 6 feet apart, all times.
Coming to you live from across town. What antiques are we talking about this week?
We're talking about fictional antiques that are fake and not real, but not in the reproduction kind of way.
No, in the never existed and never will.
We're talking about another antiques cozy mystery!
We are!
Because these are really fucking fun, turns out.
We are talking about Larceny and Old Lace by Tamar Myers.
Right off the gate, I'm going to say actually probably the most enjoyable cozy mystery I've ever read.
Really?
Yes. I'm not saying that doesn't mean it's good.
But by the standards this genre has set for you personally.
Yeah. From what I've experienced, it is good.
From the blurb. For whom the bell pull tolls. As owner of the Den of Antiquity, recently divorced but never bitter Abigail Timberlake is accustomed to delving into the past, searching for lost treasures, and navigating the cutthroat world of rival dealers at flea markets and auctions. Still, she never thought she'd be putting her expertise in mayhem and detection to other use, until crotchety junk dealer Abby's aunt Eulonia Wiggins was found murdered. Although Abigail is puzzled by the instrument of death, an exquisite antique bell pull that Aunt Eulonia never would have had the taste to acquire, she's willing to let the authorities find the culprit. But now, Auntie's priceless lace is missing, and somebody's threatened Abby's most priceless possession, her son, Charlie. It's up to Abby to put the murderer on the block.
Wow, I didn't read the blurb, but Lord Almighty, is that maybe a quarter of what we got in this book?
So they're definitely lying about her being never bitter.
100%. Well, okay, so credit where credit's due, this protagonist does at least seem to be a human being.
She does give a shit about her two children, which puts her ahead of all previous protagonists.
She feels feelings. For the most part, she goes about things in a pretty, like, decent human being way. So I gotta say, like, in terms of humanity, I'm awarding her 10 points. Most human of all the cozy mystery protagonists.
All right, plus 10 to humanity. What did you think of the antiques industry as portrayed in this book?
That's what made me like it, actually. It was really good.
It was the most antiques-heavy, antiques-cozy mystery we've had this far. The murder weapon is an antique. The motive for murder is an antique. And all of the suspects are antique stealers.
Or customers. And I just gotta say, the highlight for me was the portrayal of the customers spot on 100%.
There is a particular customer who dresses outlandishly.
Yes, and the author refers to her by at least 7 different names, so I never really nailed down who she was exactly, but her portrayal, I think, was the most accurate.
Because she was the customer from hell.
Yeah, she's just like a nightmare. At one point, she does walk in and demand a refund for a glass punch bowl that she dropped on her pavement. And it shines through that the person who wrote this has been in the antiques industry.
The customer who walks back into your shop the day after you sold them a punch bowl and says, I need a refund on the punch bowl you sold me because I broke it in my driveway. And then our protagonist says, okay, I'll give you a refund as soon as you give me all the pieces of the punch bowl.
That is dead ass an exact thing that happened at the old shop.
Amazing. I'm pretty sure I know which customer it was, too.
That was point for point, like, it has happened, and that was the response. So I was really delighted with those portrayals of customers, yeah. But also just, like, the very rich customers with the incredibly horrible attitudes that you do end up sort of bowing to because they spend a lot of money on your stuff. I'm pretty sure at one point a character says, show me what's special. Which, again, also word for word have encountered, did appreciate.
Apart from being a very antiques cozy mystery, it is also an extremely southern antiques cozy mystery.
Yeah, which is to say that it's hard to like the protagonist by the company she keeps alone.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of, like, Nazi, homophobe, general piece of shit apologism happening.
But that's also a lot of what you find in the antiques industry when you have to form a society with other antique store owners.
Yeah, which I cannot wrap my head around.
You will get the people who are like, this is just an excuse for me to write off my Nazi memorabilia on my taxes.
That was another 10 out of 10 character, by the way.
Just in terms of someone easy to loathe.
Yeah, like managed to nail that particular kind of military paraphernalia dealer just spot on.
That particular brand of jackass.
Yeah, the phrase, I don't ask people their politics, Like, it's trotting out things that I have heard more or less word for word.
Part of me while I vomit directly into the microphone.
Yeah, so it was just like, I think I would have been more comfortable with maybe some more consequences happening to those characters, but it didn't come. And which I guess it's like you said, there's a certain price of doing business in certain parts of the country, so...
It's accurate to the antiques industry, but I don't think the protagonist... The protagonist at least makes a lot of noise about not condoning it, although she still does do business with these people.
Yeah. Despite having a serious upper hand at several points.
Yeah.
But, like...
It's also interesting that the protagonist goes so hard in condemning the Nazi memorabilia dealer when she herself... says that the only reason she doesn't display the stars and bars in her shop is because she doesn't want to offend Yankee customers.
Yeah, okay, so I was going to bring that up too, where she's like weirdly racist.
Well, the American Civil War does get referred to through most of the book as the war between the states, and at one point as the war of Northern aggression, so, you know.
It's supposed to be like a cheeky reference to a hardcore stars and bars Southerner, but it doesn't ever get a lot of pushback from other characters, so that gets awkwardly like,
The word coon is used twice in text, and it's not immediately clear from context that they're referring to the animal.
Yes, that one time it is referenced also shortly before the author refers to herself as a lawn jockey.
Which, if you don't know what a lawn jockey is, it's an extremely racist lawn ornament. Caricature of a black jockey usually holding a lantern. In recent years, they are repainted to be white, but they still have the racist molding of the original caricature.
So, it's hard to miss, yeah.
Yeah, we all know what you're doing, and we wish you'd stop.
Exactly.
I guess I should clarify, this is a very white Southern book.
So yeah, racist book, too. That was weird.
A quick rundown of the types of antiques dealers featured in this book.
Oh, yes.
We have the Bible thumper Anita, the hedonist Peggy, the literal Nazi Major Calloway, the Jewish homosexual Rob Goldberg, the meticulous Gretchen, the Confederate sympathizer Winnell Crawford, and Rob's partner Bob Steuben. And I can't tell if she just picked a German name or if she was actually trying to reference von Steuben, the notoriously homosexual officer in the American Revolutionary Army.
Honest to God, after reading this, probably the latter. I think that was probably, like, on purpose.
I don't know. I'll never know.
So, I guess maybe things are different in the South, but I only connected with a couple of those archetypes. I've never in my life met a Bible-thumping antiques dealer to that extent.
You have.
Well, except for that guy who kept leaving cheek tracks all over our stuff.
I would say that qualifies, yes.
Oh, that's right. Okay, all right. Then I have to take it back, because that was another scene that I was like, haha, I do that. Because when they were talking about picking, like, Christian tracts out of furniture, very accurate. So I guess I have. They're just quieter about it up north, I guess. I've met several thousand hedonist antiques dealers, but nothing quite like the Peggy character that she described.
The Peggy character whose defining traits are she's super horny and she eats constantly.
Yeah, quick sidebar. I thought Cozy Mysteries were supposed to avoid that kind of talk.
I don't know, my dude. Every single one we've had so far has been extremely horny.
There was a lot of talk about everyone's sex life, and I didn't care to hear a single drop of it.
To the point where the protagonist's first interaction with a police officer after her aunt has been brutally murdered is spent with her just drooling after him the entire interview.
Yeah, he's like, okay, I'm so sorry, we're gonna help find the woman who killed your aunt, can you answer a few questions? And she's like trying to see if he got an erection from the cinnamon in some cinnamon buns she fed him.
Yes. This woman has priorities, but I'm not sure if they're in correct order.
This is the thing, is like very high and mighty of her to come down on Peggy.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Like, I mean, I guess call me prudish or whatever, but I really don't like running into it in these books and I wish it would stop.
Is it because you're threatened by women's sexuality?
Exactly, it's that. You've nailed it, it's precisely that. They'd all be in floor-length skirts and habits if I had my way. Sorry, wait, I also have to mention the character that demanded more of a specific shaker chair. Yes. Also an exact thing that happened for almost the same reason for a wedding.
The customer who demanded the mass production and delivery of Shaker furniture. Now, Dee, for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with Shaker furniture and why that might be an outrageous request.
Well, the Shakers are mostly dead. And also the Shaker style of furniture refers to a pretty specific period of history.
The 19th century, when the Shakers were active before they died out because part of their religious beliefs is no reproduction.
Precisely.
Which does tend to make the numbers dwindle.
They did make a fine chair, though. However, they can no longer produce them on command. Yeah, we've had that before, where someone will find a beautiful piece and then say, "Can you get me 3 more of them?" Very common, people ask you to, like, finish the set for them without understanding, like, how any of this works.
Let me just hop on over to IKEA and see if I can't pick up 3 more of these.
I'll call Walmart. Perhaps they have some more 14th century German hunting cabin.
God, if only.
Yeah, we could just go grab a few more.
Just fill my house with them. Now, the other thing I found good about this book in terms of its representation of the antiques industry is because this is the first antiques cozy mystery to A, admit that gay people are in the antiques industry, and B, recognize that this is more common necessarily than in other industries.
Yeah, that was refreshing.
We have, as mentioned earlier, the character of Rob Goldberg, the Jewish homosexual, who, despite this, is not a homosexual stereotype. Aside from being an antiques dealer, there's very little about his behavior or person that is stereotypical, and he's treated as human, if not more human, than the rest of the supporting cast, which is nice.
It's nice to see. I enjoyed that his major detractor does end up, you know, arrested, although I have my own confusions about that in plot terms, but, you know, it is good to see a character that I loathe get the comeuppance.
Yay! We also get when, as you mentioned, a character tries to come up with biblical justifications for their homophobia, we get the counter-argument, what if Jesus was gay? Which, funnily enough, is the same argument put forth by King James, yes, that King James, he of the King James Bible, which the characters are arguing over at the time. Now again, I don't know if the author knew that when she put those words into the mouths of her characters, or if this is a coincidence on par with von Steuben.
Ken, if there's anything we've learned from Cozy Mysteries, it's that there are no coincidences.
Is that what we've learned? I thought we've just learned that people are horny.
We have definitely learned that, yes. I actually gotta say, like, by and large, the intel dropped in this book is far more useful than any of the other cozy mysteries we've tapped.
Examples?
I really like that they brought up the fact that pricing things is really hard and nebulous, and almost, like, the incredibly expensive lace mentioned in the blurb is brought up multiple times, and the valuation of it tends to vary depending on who you're talking to, and I think at one point, Bob, or Rob? That was really unfair to put those characters together, by the way, for my poor little brain.
I'm assuming that was done on purpose for comedy.
Yeah. One of them mentions that there is no set pricing in the industry, and it's all kind of left up to chance, fate, and many, many, many factors.
Which was nice to have acknowledged on the page.
Yeah, well, it's definitely one of those things where, you know, if you didn't know it, it's pleasant to have someone sort of explain it. Like, in terms of if you're reading these things to learn tidbits, that's a nice tidbit. As far as I understand, all of the items referenced were accurate. I really liked them bringing up the Empire Bureau with the overhanging first drawer. I never knew how to describe those before, and I now know, actually. Definitely someone who knew their stuff. There were some bits and bobs about, like, how lace is made. It was all very accurate. A little bit about gems, you know, inclusions, carats, cuts. She goes on a bit of a tangent about what made the crystal punch bowl so nice. You know, the leading, giving it a sparkle, and the deep cuts, making it more valuable. So there's, like, a lot to glean off of it. Like I said, the author definitely actually knows their stuff.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that stuff doesn't involve plotting.
We now enter full spoiler territory. Now, Dee, what didn't fit for you about the plot?
So I forgot at certain times that the aunt was dead. Because there was so much B-plot happening that I got distracted.
There really was. There's an entire subplot about the protagonist's daughter dropping out of college to live with, like, a 40-year-old married man that goes nowhere and establishes nothing and affects no real plot or character development. It just kind of happens?
Yeah, it's just a thing that happens, and it makes other characters show up but they're already too many characters, so, like, I really wish the characters would stop showing up after a while.
Yeah.
Troy didn't need to be there at all, it turns out.
Good, because I don't remember who he was.
He's the guy who shows up at the very end and saves our protagonist, sort of. Well, he doesn't actually do that. He kind of accompanies her while she saves herself. Roy, okay, Roy,
His name is Roy, not Troy.
Okay, sorry. But yeah, so I don't really know, you know, there's a sexy lamp test, and I know that that's a feminist thing, but I would say he would be pretty easily replaceable with a sexy lamp.
He would arguably be better replaced by a sexy lamp. The sexy lamp could be an antique lamp, which would be on topic.
There are some Gone with the Wind style lamps that are extremely sexy. I know that's a hot take.
Are you talking about hurricane lamps?
No, I'm talking specifically about hurricane lamps that are overly decorative. Not every hurricane lamp is a Gone with the Wind lamp. They also, oh, big too. They always have to be very big. Yeah, I know. Like, everyone always thinks that they're a nuisance and you can't unload them. Listen, I like them. I love them. I once saw one with, like, a tufted glass shade that had lions coming out of every side of it. It was the most glorious thing I'd ever seen. What was I talking about?
That's a great question.
Oh, Roy, I don't know what he was doing there. He's a sexy lamp.
Yes.
At several points, her ex-husband shows up for, again, literally no reason.
Also, what is with cozy mysteries and recent divorces?
As a friend of ours pointed out, it is cheap drama, but the thing is, this one didn't need it. There was plenty of drama already.
That's the other thing, like, it's a murder mystery. I feel like the murder should be providing sufficient drama.
I really like the idea of a quirky ensemble cast, and the fact that none of them actually really got along, and it's like, that's plenty of drama. Like, they all, like, quietly hate each other's guts, but they have to work together, and, like, there you go. That's actually a really rich vein. Why did you throw in all the other stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, the eccentric aunt that briefly renders her homeless didn't really get that, I guess, except to show that she's at odds.
Yeah, she, in addition to her murdered aunt, she has an alive aunt, which, again, serves no purpose. We also get to hear about her brother on the other side of the country who never contacts her and who holds true to that by never contacting her or having anything to do with the rest of the book.
Hey, can we talk about the brother? She has trouble naming people, I think.
Because the brother's name is Toy.
And he works as a male stripper? Yes. So he's literally a boy toy?
Who, again, does nothing, signifies nothing, affects nothing, and might as well not exist. I would have loved to red pen this book and just go through and eliminate entire characters and subplots that just don't need to be here.
Pat her on the back and be like, look, I know you were planning a series. Just can this stuff and save it for later.
Yeah, seriously.
Like, I'm sure this will work somewhere down the line, but not in this book. Stop distracting me. Daddy's got work to do. There's just so much B-plot. There's so much fucking B-plot.
There's an entire scene where she goes to a bogus indie yoga instructor who turns out to just be, like, a rapist.
Yeah.
And it's played for comedy, which is, an interesting choice.
I mean, I guess I do laugh when I see people like that get hurt.
Yeah, no, it's great to see him getting eaten in the balls, but I also don't see why he had to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of B-plots that I really couldn't... I didn't really understand what the point of the bell pull... Can we talk about how very little of the main antagonist's plot made sense?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So the murderer is the Bible-thumping antique dealer, Anita. And her reason for doing it is that basically God's telling her what to do directly in her brain, which is, hey, if that sounds like something you're going through right now, please talk to a qualified mental health professional who can help you out with that. That said, she doesn't do that. Instead, she does a murder. And I guess her justification is she has to kill the aunt because the aunt is a sinner, because the aunt has ill-gotten gains that Anita wants. And also she has to frame Rob Goldberg for it because he is both Jewish and a homosexual, and neither of those things are Christian, so he's gotta go.
She never at any point illuminates us as to what on earth. She keeps talking about, like, oh, the money would be furthering God's mission, but, like, I expected them to throw out, like, I'm gonna take it to Nicaragua and help children, but, like, she just says, like, the money, and then drops it there, and I'm like, you're not really building this character much here.
It's also interesting because the author herself, her parents were Christian missionaries in, I forget which country specifically, but...
But no country deserves that?
Yeah. So that's the author's background, and this is the antagonist she chooses to create.
Imagine being her mother and reading this and being like, oh. Oh dear.
Well, Whoopsies.
Why the whole B plot with her mom, and who brings up the idea that their mom is having sex that often?
Maybe it's a Southern thing. Perhaps that is Southern culture, is contemplating at all hours whether or not your mother is having sex.
I thought it was a Mormon thing.
Mormons, funnily enough, don't factor into this book.
I guess they're not west enough for that. I think they're in the Carolinas.
I believe so.
I mean, I know at this point I really should stop expecting cozy mysteries to, like, set up and pay off instead of wildly confuse me with the end result.
The endings all feel like the author wasn't expecting them.
Yeah, like it's a cutesy phrase, but it feels like, in this case, the characters actually came alive and finished the story on their own. Without any consent.
We go from a quirky, character-driven tour of the antiques industry in this particular town, picking up clues to solve a murder mystery, and then suddenly we're on a backcountry mudding ride with Vin Diesel through a thunderstorm, and also a missionary killer is here.
This is a near-biblical ball lightning that ends up, like, kind of becoming the Deus Machina in the situation.
Yeah.
I'd just like to remind everyone that ball lightning doesn't even definitively exist. So, that was a rough, was a wild choice.
Neither do antiques.
Oh my god. So deep.
Like, think about it, won't you? Thank you.
Think about it.
But really think about it.
What happened to mysteries, like, feeding me clues and then letting me be satisfied when I thought I figured it out?
It feels like none of these authors want to be writing mysteries. It feels like they'd rather be writing any different kind of book than a mystery, but they're just, like, taping a mystery onto the other book they wanted to make.
Actually, it feels like, to a book, they all want to be writing romantic thrillers.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Hey, wait a minute, yeah!
All these books take more stock in putting me off guard than setting up and paying off a mystery.
Yeah, they all want us to be shocked at every turn and also keenly aware of how horny the protagonist is at all times.
Yeah, they are all writing romantic thrillers, but none of them know it.
Oh my god.
Or they themed it, which they think makes it a cozy mystery.
That's... Wow, I need to go home and think about some stuff.
You're already home. Ken walks from his room out into the living room. I gotta go home and think about some stuff.
Yeah.
I gotta say, the humor was better in this one. I was genuinely amused at many points.
It was pretty quippy.
Granted, I'm looking at this through the eyes of someone who doesn't know, like, a lot of Southerners. It felt like a very classically Southern kind of, like, humor.
Very, you know your neighbor's business, but you're not going to tell them that you know their business, except in a one-off comment that you can easily pretend was just hospitality.
Yeah, like, the humor works better. It doesn't end up giving the protagonist, I don't even remember her name. Jesus Christ.
That's the thing, these are all written in the why are all these written in the first person? It's my least favorite- Okay, no, that's not true. Second person exists, but it's one of my least favorite-
Hey, you leave House of Leaves out of this.
Points of view to be reading a narrative from.
I don't like first person. I don't like it at all.
I think it works in young adult and not really much elsewhere.
Yeah, I think you're right. I preferred the Hunger Games approach, which was changing it to be significant to the character. So if I can recall correctly, Hunger Games, like, volleys between first and third. And first is so that you get a sense of, like, desperation and panic and suspense, and then it switches to third when they need to extrapolate on things. And that was very clever.
Do you remember that time you read the Hunger Games in my kitchen, and by the end of the second page, you were on the floor writhing around screaming about how bad the writing was?
Listen, I said they made a clever choice. I didn't say it was a good book.
Okay.
I just believe in credit where credit's due.
Just clarifying.
Credit where credit's due. I still don't like the book.
Literally on the tile, writhing and shrieking about how much The Hunger Games sucked.
Berries don't explode in your mouth. I can't stress it enough.
I have video. Speaking of funny bits, I do have one quote. This wasn't as quotable as the previous books, but I do have one quote, which is, "Your granny was a Yankee whore who came south with Sherman's troops."
Yeah.
Which is certainly, something you can say to another human being if you don't value your life.
I don't know, I liked it, because I hated that woman.
I feel like it plays better above the Mason-Dixon line.
Oh, I do have a quotable quote, which is at the point where she name drops Sue Grafton.
She name drops Sue Grafton when she's describing a fictional mystery writer who happens to go to the same church that the protagonist does and claims to have been raised by missionaries in a third world country. Congratulations, yeah. You have found the author's self-insert.
Yeah, she Stephen King'd the whole thing and then name drops Sue Grafton. Like, as if to say, I also read other mysteries. Like, also, Sue Grafton, like, largely writes thrillers, which explains a lot, but hey.
Sue Grafton's not the murderer, is she?
No, that's, well, that doesn't matter. It's not.
Oh, God. Now I can't even remember the murder case. All I can think is Pretty Little Liars, but that's not it. Heavenly Creatures, there we go.
Wait.
I did just confuse Heavenly Creatures and Pretty Little Liars.
Wait, the writer of Heavenly Creatures is a murderer?
No, one of the girls that Heavenly Creatures is about went on to become a mystery writer.
Right, okay, I'm confused.
Juliet Holm, who straight up murdered a woman when she was a teenager, is now the murder mystery writer Anne Perry.
Oh, that! Okay, I thought you were talking about the young adult novel. I didn't know you were talking about the true crime novel.
Yes.
Okay, alright. Now that we've got that settled.
Anyway, we figured out that Sue Grafton is not Anne Perry, and really, isn't that enough for you, America? Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. I was delighted to see an author self-insert. Again, with the naming, I did take a special note of a certain name, which is that at least one of the fancy rich lady's friends is named Mignon.
Which is French for cute.
I mean, I guess I can't put it above, like, a rich white southerner to name their kid something like that, but it's just one of those things where it feels like you thought about the beefsteak, and then you were like, that's a nice name.
I don't think she was named after filet mignon.
Yeah, but when you make that choice, you make the choice of, knowing everyone's going to associate it that way.
Oh, no.
I'm just saying, like, it's not Dickens 2, Electric Dickaloo.
So yeah, that is Larceny and Old Lace. Dee, final thoughts?
Liked it. Overall, pleasant read. Had a good time.
Did you find it a pleasant enough read to read the next book in the series?
I would try it, yeah. I'm actually a little curious about how many more B-plots she can get rolling in the next one.
Excellent, because it is available from my library as a digital loan.
Here we go.
Oh,
and nothing was in parentheses, which was nice. It was a nice break.
Zero parentheses. It was beautiful.
Yeah, my head was finally quiet.
If you would like to suggest other antiques, cozy mysteries for us to read, or give us your own opinion on Larceny and Old Lace or any of the other books we've read, you can email us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com. If you would like other people to listen to this podcast, you can scroll down to where you're listening to this and leave a review.
Please do. That helps get our name out there, gets our dulcet tones in other ears.
We got a particularly fun review this week titled Limerick for a Podcast.
Oh dear.
From Beast with the Least. A young man who so loved the antiques, upon hearing this podcast for freaks, leapt in joy from his chair whilst on end stood his hair, shouting, C'est absolument magnifique.
Anyway, listen, we got a lot of really good reviews, but that one might actually be my favorite right now.
It's pretty fucking great. Thank you, Beast with the Least.
It's neck and neck with more horse.
If you are writing a review, you don't have to do a limerick. You can also do a haiku. But really, any review is appreciated and does help us.
Ballads also accepted. Sonnet. Whatever you want, really. E.E. Cummings style mess.
Oh, God.
Let the spirit move you.
All of our plums are eaten. If you would like to listen to deleted scenes, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. And through there, you can support the podcast and get us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes.
Consider it, won't you?
Thank you. Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and keeping the podcast lights on and filling our hearts with so much love.
Oh God, just so much love.
And thank you in particular for listening.
That's right, you.
Goodbye.
Bye.